Warning, the first portion of the following podcast contains adult language, sexual imagery, and some stuff to make you say, man, that's kind of a dirty play. Skip to the 10-minute, 12-second mark if easily offended. You have been warned. Well met, and welcome to episode 158, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for August 20th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at the Bill Shakespeare Project. .com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we continue our 2-month-long discussion of The Winter's Tale with a discussion of body in the play and some video reviews. But first, an apology. It's been nearly a month since our last podcast. I do believe this is the longest stretch that did not include a hiatus to the blog. Time's been at a premium, and both blog and podcast have suffered. I'm sorry. On the other hand, my yearly sojourn to Ashland was great, and my participation at the Utah Shakespeare Festival's Wooden O Symposium was, as far as I'm concerned, a great success. But now it's back to work. So, without any further ado, let's get nasty. Explicit content, adult language, and sophomoric sex humor ahead. Skip to the 10-minute, 12-second mark if easily offended. Now, Eric Partridge, in his study of and dictionary for the body in the Bard, Shakespeare's body, has this to say about our play. Cymbeline, in many ways, resembles The Winter's Tale, which is slightly less body but rather more sexual. They are of much the same quantitative order as All's Well. Now, All's Well got some dirt, but isn't that dirty? Cymbeline pretty much the same, so let's see if Partridge is right. Unlike Cymbeline, where the bodiness took a while to rear its head, here in The Winter's Tale, we don't get 200 lines into the play before we get a sexual reference. And given Leontes is racked with sexual jealousy, it should be no surprise that when he sees what he interprets as caressing between his wife and best friend, paddling, his mind immediately goes to images of cuckoldry and its legendary symbol of horns, forked ones, growing from his forehead or brows. He fears that he's being made a cuckold, fears that his wife's been sluiced in his absence and his pond fished by his next neighbor. Here he envisions his wife being drenched as if by a rush of water from a dam releasing its contents, sluice from the OED. Only the liquid he imagines is probably not water, but cum. And his fishing comment recalls Measure for Measure's Pompey describing Claudio's crime as groping for trouts in a peculiar river. Because of woman's predominant lack of chastity, the entire world to Leontes is a body planet in which there is no barricado for a belly. It will let in and out the enemy with bag and baggage. In other words, as there is no wall to protect the womb, she will let in the enemy, the other man, and empty his testicles, bag, of his semen, baggage, into her. And worse, Leontes fears that everyone else knows it. They're here with me already, whispering, rounding, Cecilia's, and so forth. When he attempts to convince Camillo, he again refers to a cuckold's horn and calls Hermione slippery and a hobby horse, there to be ridden by any man. He accuses her of kissing with the inside lip, the lips inside her dress, perhaps, and in an explosion of repetition he proclaims, "Is this nothing? Why, then the world and all that's in it's nothing. The covering sky is nothing, Bohemia nothing, my wife is nothing, nor nothing have these nothings if this be nothing." Sure, he could mean nothing, but then again, nothing had another meaning. Remember Much Ado About Nothing? Anyway, Leontes is obsessed, demented, extra crazed bonus points for the use of covering, as cover also meant the act of a stallion copulating with a mare. And Camillo sees that this diseased opinion is most dangerous. Undeterred, Leontes envisions the purity and whiteness of his sheets being dirty. That's something. Something disturbingly body, and that, my friends, is just the second scene of the play. Act 2, Scene 1 brings more of Leontes' delusional rantings, calling the now-departed Camillo the pander or pimp for Polixenes, and declaring that it is Polixenes who has made Hermione swell thus with pregnancy. Later in the scene, in a bizarrely misogynistic attempt at placating the crazed king, Antigonus says that if the accusations against the queen are true, then of his own three daughters, I'll geld them all. 14 they shall not see to bring false generations. They are co-heirs, and I had rather glib myself than they should not produce fair issue. He claims that he will sterilize, geld his own daughters, and that he'd rather castrate glib himself before he lets them give birth to bastard children. What the fuck? Seriously? Actually, probably not really seriously, as I'm pretty damn sure that this is all just talk to keep Leontes preoccupied. But still. Of course, he cannot distract Leontes from his obsession, and after Paulina presents the newborn baby to the king, he calls her a bawd, or a madam, for Hermione. And then we get pretty much no bawdiness for the remainder of the time in Sicilia. But come Act 4 in Bohemia! In Act 4, Scene 3, we learn two new phrases for prostitutes from Autolycus. Aunts, with whom he lies tumbling in the hay, and trollmydames, referencing a game where you roll balls through arches. Balls through arches. Okay. At the sheep-shearing festival, when Perdita is handing out flowers too and discussing items of botanical interest with the disguised Polixenes, we get a number of body-not-body references by the young maid. I'll not put the dibble in the earth, the dibble being a tool for making holes in the soil, a phallic object. If wearing makeup, a young man might desire to breed by her. Virgin branches, maidenheads, a malady most incident to maids. Here she's talking about green sickness, a supposed sickness prone to virgins that could be cured by having sex. Now, all of these are within a short span, and all of them with Polixenes and Camillo. Is this supposed to give us a teasing, almost flirtatious Perdita? Or, more likely, in my opinion, a completely innocent, guileless young shepherdess who is comfortable about talking about what comes naturally, unaware that it could even be taken dirtily? Now, the rest of the play's body references all come in the second half of the scene, after the announcement of the arrival of Autolycus with his delicate burden of dildos and fadings, jumper and thumper, and where some stretch-mouth rascal would, as it were mean mischief, break foul and gap in the matter. On the subject of dildos, never thought I'd use that phrase in the podcast, the body blog entry included the phrase BYOD, as in bring your own. You know, that underutilized dildo. Underutilized, as this is the only mention in the entire canon of dildos. Not what you were thinking. Now whose mind is in the gutter, huh? Huh? Anyway, while dildos and fadings could mean silly words in a refrain and other song portions, I mean, come on, who are we kidding here? Jumper and thumper? Really? Stretch-mouthed means foul-mouth, though other oral interpretations wouldn't be too much of a stretch. See what I did there? Of course, what makes all of this all the funnier is that the servant saying all of it is introducing Autolycus as having items without bawdry. Shakespeare does like his irony. The clown then talks of plackets and kiln holes, the latter being an oven, as in a bun in, and the former we've known for a while as a euphemism for pussy. When Autolycus begins to interact with the shepherds, his language is filled with slightly dirty references. A usurer's wife was brought to bed of 20 money bags at a burden. Now I'm thinking she brought 20 men to her bed to burden her, although I guess it could be one really rich man, I suppose. Mistress Tale Porter. Sure, that could mean gossip, a tale reporter. But since he follows it up with talk of 5 or 6 honest wives, I think he's saying that the mistress is a doorkeeper for tails, T-A-I-L-S, in other words, a bawd. Exchange flesh, he uses, having sex. Now, after the king and Camillo have revealed themselves, it's Polixenes' turn to use some questionable language in regards to the sex act. Copist with, to screw, and accusing Perdita of these rural latches to his entrance open. She has left her doors unlocked for Florizel's easy access. And once the king's gone, we have only Autolycus to give us one last bawdry blast before the end of the scene. We get another placket and a codpiece. And with that placket and codpiece, the dirty disappears from the winner's tale. There are no body references in Sicilia in the final act. Leontes, the main speaker of the Salacious, has been cured of his dangerous, diseased opinion and dirty diction. And as for Partridge, he's right. This does feel a tiny bit more sexual than Cymbeline, but not by much. Shakespeare fans, need a poster to hang in your room? Teachers, need some nifty handouts for your students to peruse as you introduce them to the Bard? Or are you just in the mood for some printable versions of some of the cool infographics found on this website? Well, regardless of how you answered those questions, I've got a scratch for that itch, a solution for that problem. Check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the Teachers Pay Teachers website. You can find character maps for Romeo and Juliet and Julius Caesar previewing the characters and their relationships to one another. I've also got geographical maps so your students can wrap their heads around travels within the plays Troilus and Cressida. Yes, even TNC gets some love. All's Well That Ends Well as well. See what I did there? Plus Pericles and Othello. There's also handouts on the so-called history in Macbeth and Julius Caesar, time in Romeo and Juliet, and violence in Titus Andronicus. Also, you'll find entire packets of handouts for both King Lear and Macbeth, including scene-by-scene timelines and the interactions as well as relationships between the characters. And I'll be adding even more soon. Plus, this is where you can find the printable version of the new and improved periodic table of Shakespeare. Some of these are for free, and some are for purchase, but all can be found on the Bill Shakespeare Project page on teacherspayteachers.com. Oh, and if you want to purchase a pre-printed poster-sized version of that periodic table, well then head on over to the Bill Shakespeare Project page on redbubble.com. Links to both of these sites can be found in the left-hand margin of this website. Okay, there aren't many videos for The Winter's Tale, so let's take a quick look at them. First up is one of the first films of The Winter's Tale, a silent film from 1910. Like the last play's silent rendition of Cymbeline, this is a short one. How short, you ask? How about half as long as that film's 22 minutes, just 12 minutes? Kind of. More on that later. And like that flick, there's no Shakespeare text here, or stage direction. Again, more later. Not much is known about the filmmakers. No known director. Screenplay is credited to a Lloyd F. Lonergan and Gertrude Thanhauser, co-founder with her husband Edwin, of the production company, the Thanhauser Company. The print comes courtesy of the Library of Congress, but it's not in good shape. In fact, it's pretty horrible. Incomplete, blotchy, bubbly, scratched. There are no opening credits, and this is part of that incomplete state. It simply opens with a court scene. With a fairly prominent jester, who appears in all the Cecilia scenes. Huh? Anyway, at about the 1 minute 20 mark, we get our first intertitle, which tells us about jealous Leontes, the plot to poison Polixenes, and his escape. Leontes' command to abandon the baby comes before Hermione's collapse, which seems to be caused by the news of the baby's ordered fate. There is no Mamilius. In Bohemia, there is no bear. Antigonus lives to see another day. Now, after Hermione's collapse, we get a very interesting intertext. Believed dead by all but Paulina, the queen revives and escapes. Moreover, we see it happen. The 15-year jump works more easily with the intertext than with the clumsy use of the choric figure time. When we meet Florizel, he's dressed as a shepherd, with an animal skin that looks suspiciously like a tiger's skin. Is this supposed to be a shout-out to the dangerous animals in Bohemia, though we don't see a bear? I don't know. Instead of sheep-shearing feast, it's a betrothal feast for Florizel and Perdita. When they head to Sicilia, we get another intertext that takes a different tact. The lovers fly to the repentant king of Sicilia who recognizes his daughter. And then there is the recognition and walking away by all. That's it. Seriously, the end. No resolution to the Hermione character and her living fate. Of course, that's because, most likely, that last scene has been lost to history. Again, incompleteness rears its ugly, decapitated, missing head. It would be interesting to see how they played it off, since it's no doubt that she's real and not a miraculous statue. So, should you see this? Well, if you can see it for free, sure. I mean, right now, the only way to see it is through Fandor, which is a subscription service, though you can do a free week trial, which is what I did. Now let's take a look at one of the only widely released films of The Winter's Tale, the BBC Complete Works entry from 1981. In late 1980, the BBC took on The Winter's Tale as part of the third season of their Complete Works series. This one was directed by Jane Howell, who would later direct some of the more visually interesting plays in the series. The first tetralogy, the three Henry VI plays and Richard III, as well as Titus Andronicus. This one, too, is visually striking, especially for the BBC. A single set, almost abstract, geometric, and white. The play's film opens with a red ball bouncing onto this white set, as tossed by Mamilius. Howell uses this concept of color throughout the play. Polixenes is dressed in earth tones, Leontes black. During the Bohemia sequences, while the palace is set in off-white, for the shepherd scenes, the same set, now outdoors, is green with golden fields. During the Cecilia first half, the white background has a very interesting consequence. All of the characters seem separated from reality as if placed in another world, so that even when we get the still artificial set of Bohemia, it looks natural in comparison. In the final scene, the background moves from black to whites to greens. It's pretty effective. She also has the actors do the asides directly to the camera, as if on stage. Autolycus uses this to greatest effect, even when the aside isn't his own. Near the end of Act 4, when Camillo is revealing his plan to the audience, Autolycus peers over his shoulder to look at us questioningly. It's a pretty fine comic moment. Now, if all of this sounds great, it is, from a visual point of view. The rest, however, for me, is less than great. The first act feels dead, but it grows in intensity so that by Act 2, the production seems to find its energy, finally, and the third act, deaths are surprisingly moving. But when we get to Bohemia, we get that dip in energy again. This sheep-shearing just isn't all that festive. The last portion of that ridiculously long Act 4 scene 4 just feels so long, almost excruciatingly so. And because of this dead spot, Act 5 suffers. So I know what you're wondering. What about those two sequences that are the bane of the director's existence, the bear and the statue? How does Howell fare there? Alas, eh. She uses the most ridiculous guy in a bear suit. I see how this might work. If the rest of the Bohemia stuff is quick, almost farcical, or at least wild, but it's not. And the reveal tries to have it both ways. There is this weird moment when, in the captain's exposition discussion of Paulina's statue, when the Sicilian men in attendance, upon hearing of the Italian artist, give one another a look, as if to say, "What? Oh," as if to let us know that they've figured it out. But if they figured it out, no one in that last scene does. Not the actors, not Howell. It's played straight. And here's the interesting thing. Because it's played as a miracle, I thought it carried some emotional heft. But because it was set up not to be a miracle, it made the ending feel like a fake, and thus not very memorable, or memorable for the wrong reasons. I know, this review is a mess. It's all over the place. Well, fancy that. Matches the movie. Do I recommend it? Yes, because it's really kind of the only professional one out there. I say kinda because of all the BBC Complete Works series, this has been the toughest to come by. Even my usual source, the LA Public Library, didn't have it, nor did my local. It wasn't available for streaming. I had to subscribe to DVD.com, you know, Netflix, before it went streaming only. So I think you should see it, as it's the only game in town, but only if you can find it for free. Enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entry since our last regular podcast, and that was a long time ago, you've missed out on subjects including Measure for Measure, Theater Review, Late to the Party, again, Greetings from Ashland, Theater Review, Shakespeare in Love by Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Theater Review, the first and second parts of Henry IV. Theater Review, The Merry Wives of Windsor. Theater Review, Off the Rails. And Theater Review, Julius Caesar, all of these by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. The Winter's Tale, Hamlet and Fartles and Bears, Oh My. Seasons, A Midsummer Night's Feast. Friday Film Focus, The Winter's Tale, 1981, BBC. The Winter's Tale, Staging the Bear. Polixenes and Leontes, Fear and Loathing in Sicilia. Greetings from Cedar City, Utah. Report from Utah, Wooden O Symposium at the Utah Shakespeare Festival and Southern Utah University. Report from Utah, Day 2. Friday Non-Film Focus, The Two Gentlemen of Verona by Independent Shakespeare Company. Report from Utah, Day 3. Genres, Pivots, and Order, The Winter's Tale. Explicit Bodiness in Winter, BYOD. Who is this about again? The Winter's Tale, Scattered Opposites. And Indoor and Outdoor. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook and Twitter feed. But remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for the discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast when we'll wrap up The Winter's Tale with a conclusion and a cast and a concept. Hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for August 20th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.